We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. How are you today, Bob?
I'm barely here, Hampton. We had last night's winter time, and you're familiar with conditions up here. So I was coaching last night in Glenwood, and then I go to drive home, and there had, just before I left the pool, there had been a semi wreck in the canyon. So
they had the exit there by Village Inn blocked off, so you couldn't take
blocked off, just trucks lined up everywhere, you know, for miles, can't get through either direction. I sent you a picture, horrific crash. I mean, no one was hurt. You wonder how yeah. On earth did no one get hurt? I mean, half of the truck is on the upper level, half's on the bottom level, man. And we had the same thing almost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I had to stay in Glenwood last night.
Yeah. It seems like I-70 gets shut down way too often.
Way too often. But I'm here, ready to roll. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm ready to go.
Let's dive in. So,
Daniel?
Yeah, I'd love to start in Daniel again, because, you know, as we roll through how the West won, in a sense, you know, what he means by won is created a much greater culture for the citizens. I think that's what he means, you know, a dominant culture where, and you know, a lot of this is accurate. Boy, you'd be hard pressed to find someone that's more the common guy than me. A house, two refrigerators, a couple cars. You know what I mean? The wealth in the United States from that perspective, that the middle class is very comfortable. That's unique in history.
Yeah.
And so what he's describing from a sociologist's point of view is how that happened. So a lot of the tools of a sociologist, you know, are history. And we'll get into some interesting things that they use for research, right? Some of the stuff they did in Germany, we'll get to that today. Some of the stuff they looked up, it's so interesting. But all that to say, so Stark's examining things from a sociologist's point of view, but Daniel is giving us a divine point of view of how history is unfolding. And in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has his dream, and the book really doesn't progress further than that as far as more data. It just gives you precision on that statue. So today we'll read Daniel chapter 11, and we're going to get remarkable detail about that third kingdom, Greece, and one person in particular out of that third kingdom, Antiochus Epiphanes. And the reason we're going to get so much detail on him is because he's what's called biblically a type. And a type is maybe a good way to begin to grasp that is it's a picture. It's an example of something to come. So for instance, if I showed someone a quarter, if I took a 25-cent piece out of my pocket and showed you that, you know, with the heads side up, and I said, hey, Hampton, who is that? You'd say George Washington, right? You wouldn't even hesitate. But right. You know that that's not exactly him. That's his representation. So Antiochus Epiphanes is the type. He's the picture of the Antichrist to come. So you get the better part of this chapter in amazing detail on Antiochus Epiphanes. That's what's going to happen down the road, you know, further on from Daniel chapter 11, that he represents the coming Antichrist. So just to set this up, so we don't have to slow down too much while we're reading, he's going to begin with Persia, describing Persia, but briefly. I mean, that's going to take a verse or two. And then you're going to get a reference to Alexander the Great. And then we know in history, Alexander only lived to about 33 years old. And he never produced, I don't know if he had other children, but he never produced a recognized heir. And so on his deathbed, you know, it was a real concern because he's got this worldwide empire in 10 years that he conquered, walking, by the way. And so his generals, you know, they're concerned, like, hey, who does this go to now? And he says, to the fittest. So you guys fight it out and decide. So he died and that happened. They fought it out. And eventually, you know, over maybe 10, 20 year span, came down to four guys, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus, divided up the world kingdom of Greece. Now, two of those become very important, two sort of fade off into history. But Seleucus and Ptolemy become very important. So Ptolemy takes Egypt and, you know, and surrounding areas, but primarily Egypt. And Seleucus took north of that. And so right in between there is Israel. So they get bounced back and forth like a ping pong ball. Mm-hmm. So just so we have that historical context, when you read this, you'll see what happens. And then most of the Seleucid, like Ptolemy, his empire in Egypt, Cleopatra's a descendant of that. And then, you know, in the north, the Seleucid kingdom, most of their kings were named Antiochus something. Okay, so the main Antiochus king that we're going to focus on, that Daniel is in this chapter, is Antiochus Epiphanes. And you can recognize by his name, right, the pride associated with that. So Epiphanes, you know, you might translate that something like God manifest. I'm Antiochus, God on earth, is what he's saying. And in historical terms, you know, to a world historian, he would have been a blip on the map. But in the biblical perspective, he's a big player because he's going to do some things to Israel that the coming Antichrist is going to do. So one last thing about this, and then we'll dive into the text. About halfway through the material on Antiochus, there's a subtle switch. And you start getting details explicitly about the Antichrist. And this is referred to in the gospel accounts, right? When Jesus says, when you see the abomination that causes desolation, and he's quoting Daniel. He's quoting Daniel chapter 11. You know, he goes, then it's time to flee Jerusalem. So very important passage. Maybe one last thing, Hampton, before we dive in. This is perhaps the most disputed passage in the Old Testament as far as critical scholarship goes. And the reason is there are quite a few very highly skilled biblical scholars that are not Christian. It's just their area of study. And they just cannot believe that this chapter was written when I would say it was written. And I would date this, you know, towards the latter part of Daniel's life. He was taken captive as a young guy, a teenager, in 605 BC. So I'd put this chapter somewhere around 530.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere around there. Well, you're getting so much precision. And we know, as historians today, this stuff's accurate. Well, right. Well, how could 200 years, right? Daniel's prophesying, you know, over 200 years in advance. How could you be that accurate? How could you know who's going to marry who and so on? You, I mean, you can't, except God can. But right. That's why this chapter's so debated. So,
okay,
let's dive in. Daniel chapter 11. Three more kings will arise for Persia. Then a fourth king will be unusually rich, more so than all who preceded him. When he's amassed power through his riches, he'll stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a powerful king will arise, exercising great authority and doing as he pleases. That's Alexander. Shortly after his rise to power, his kingdom will be broken up and distributed towards the four winds of the sky, but not to his posterity or with the authority he exercised, for his kingdom will be uprooted and distributed to others besides these. I've got to pause. Really? 200 plus years before you knew that Alexander would not have an heir?
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, just that fact alone,
right,
is supernatural. So verse 5, then the king of the south, that's the Ptolemy reign, and one of his subordinates will grow strong. His subordinate will resist him and will rule a kingdom greater than his. After some years have passed, they will form an alliance. Then the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north, that's the Seleucid kingdom, to make agreement, but she will not retain her power, nor will he continue in his strength. She, together with the one who brought her, her child, and her benefactor, will be delivered over at that time. There will arise in his place one from her family line who will come against their army and will enter the stronghold of the king of the north, will move against them successfully. He'll also take their gods into captivity to Egypt, along with their cast images and prized utensils of silver and gold. Then he'll withdraw for some years from the king of the north. Then the king of the north will advance against the empire of the king of the south, but will withdraw to his own land. His sons will wage war, mustering a large army, which will advance like an overflowing river and carrying the battle all the way to the enemy's fortress. So another short pause. So all this stuff is known in history, right? If we had our history books open before us, you could pinpoint all those references.
Mm-hmm.
So verse 11.
It's helpful, isn't it? Bible has in the footnotes, it has the names of.
Yeah, who that's talking about.
Yeah.
Very good. Then the king of the south will be enraged. It'll march out to fight against the king of the north, who will also muster a large army. But that army will be delivered into his hand. When the army's taken away, the king of the south will become arrogant. He'll be responsible for the death of thousands and thousands of people. But he will not continue to prevail, for the king of the north will again muster an army, and one larger than before. At the end of some years, he will advance with a huge army and enormous supplies. In those times, many will oppose the king of the south. Those who are violent among your own people will rise up in confirmation of the vision. but they will falter. Then the king of, by the way, sorry to pause again. So that would be a reference to Israel, right? Your own people, right? Mm-hmm. They'll rise up.
Okay.
So verse 15, then the king of the north will advance and will build siege mounds and capture a well-fortified city. The forces of the south will not prevail, not even his finest contingents. They will have no strength to prevail. The one advancing against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to stand before him. He'll prevail in the beautiful land, and its annihilation will be within his power. So the beautiful land, there would be a reference to Israel. His intention will be to come with the strength of his entire kingdom, and he will form alliances. He will give the king of the south a daughter in marriage in order to destroy the kingdom, but it'll not turn out to his advantage. Then he will turn his attention to the coastal regions and will capture many of them. But a commander will bring his shameful conduct to a halt. In addition, he will make him pay for his shameful conduct. He will then turn his attention to the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall, not to be found again. There will arise after him one who will send out an exactor of tribute to enhance the splendor of the kingdom. But after a few days, he will be destroyed, though not in anger or battle. Then there will arise in his place a despicable person. Okay, so now we've transitioned into Antiochus Epiphanes, to whom the royal honor has not been rightfully conferred. He will come to the scene in a time of prosperity and will seize the kingdom through deceit. Armies will be suddenly swept away in defeat before him. Both they and a covenant leader will be destroyed. After entering into an alliance with him, he will behave treacherously. He'll ascend to power with only a small force. In a time of prosperity, for the most productive areas of the province, he will come and accomplish what neither his fathers nor their fathers accomplished. He'll distribute loot, spoils, and property to his followers, and he'll devise plans against fortified cities, but not for long. He will rouse his strength and enthusiasm against the king of the south with a large army. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he'll not be able to prevail because of the plans devised against him. Those who share the king's fine food will attempt to destroy him, and his army will be swept away. Many will be killed in battle. These two kings, their minds filled with evil intentions, will trade lies with one another at the same table, but it will not succeed, for there is still an end at the appointed time. Then the king of the north will return to his own land with much property. His mind will be set against the holy covenant. He'll take action, then return to his own land. And at appointed time, he will again invade the south. But his latter visit will not turn out the way the former one did. The ships of Kittim will come against him. That's a reference to Rome. And leave him disheartened. He will turn back and direct his indignation against the Holy Covenant. He'll return and honor those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His forces will rise up and profane the fortified sanctuary, stopping the daily sacrifice. In its place, they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. Then with smooth words, he'll defile those who have rejected the covenant. But the people who are loyal to their God will act valiantly. This is all recorded in Maccabees, Hampton.
Okay.
These who are wise among the people will teach the masses. However, they'll fall by the sword and by the flame, and they will be imprisoned and plundered for some time. When they stumble, they'll be granted some help, but many will unite with them deceitfully. Even some of the wise will stumble, resulting in their refinement, purification and cleansing until the time of the end, for it's still for the appointed time. And you can see from that last phrase, now we're going to jump forward to the Antichrist. Okay. Then the king will do as he pleases. He'll exalt and magnify himself above every deity, and he'll utter presumptuous things against the God of gods. He'll succeed until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been decreed must occur. He will not respect the gods of his fathers, not even the god loved by women. He'll not respect any god. He'll elevate himself above them all. What he will honor is a god of fortresses, a god his fathers did not acknowledge. He'll honor with gold, silver, valuable stones, and treasured commodities. He'll attack mighty fortresses aided by a foreign deity. To those who recognize him, he will grant considerable honor. He'll place them in authority over many people, and he'll parcel out land for a price. At that time, the end of the king of the south will attack him. Then the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, horsemen, and a large armada of ships. He'll invade lands, passing through them like an overflowing river. Then he'll enter the beautiful land. Many will fall, but these will escape: Edom, Moab, the Ammonite leadership. He'll extend his power against their lands. The land of Egypt will not escape. He will have control over the hidden stores of gold and silver, as well as the treasures of Egypt. Libyans and Ethiopians will submit to him, but reports will trouble him from the east and north. And he'll set out in a tremendous rage to destroy and wipe out many. He'll pitch his royal tents between the seas toward the beautiful holy mountain, but he'll come to his end with no one to help him. Wow.
A lot in there.
Isn't there? A lot of detail.
Yeah.
So.
Very, very good.
Let's press on.
Okay, well, we're going to do chapter 12, The Golden Empire, and I'm not going to do as much reading. I'm going to just summarize, but he talks about Spain and during the 1500s and about the immense amount of gold and silver that they hauled out of Central and South America. And at first, they just took it from the natives because they were all wearing the golden trinkets and jewelry. But then they started actually mining it. And he said in one place that between 1521 and 1590, an astonishing 200 tons of gold and more than 18,000 tons of silver were exported to Spain. And those are only the official figures. It's estimated that as much as an additional 50% was smuggled into Spain to avoid giving the crown its legal share. To grasp the magnitude of this flow of precious metals, consider that even counting only the official figures, these imports tripled Europe's supply of silver and increased the gold supply by 20%.
Yeah. Overwhelming. You know, another fun one to read, Hampton, in that section, I know we don't want to belabor this, but I thought this one was so fun, that giant ship that was captured by England. Mm-hmm. Remember the Madre de Deus, the mother of God? Let me just read some details about that, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So, thus in 1592, a six-ship English squadron lying in wait just off the Azores intercepted the enormous carrack, Madre de Deus, and seized the largest treasure ever. She was the biggest ship the English had ever seen. As Harvard scholar David S. Landis recorded, the Madre de Deus was 165 feet long, 47 feet of beam, 1,600 tons, three times the size of the biggest ship in England, seven decks, 32 guns, plus other arms. As for treasure, the chest bulging with jewels and pearls, gold and silver coins, 425 tons of pepper, 45 tons of cloves, 35 tons of cinnamon, and much else. The total value was estimated at 500,000 pounds, and a large share of this catch was owed to the queen. The loss of this treasure was a terrible blow to the Spanish economy. Oh my gosh.
That's huge.
Man, that's big.
Well, I'm getting ahead of myself a bit. That ties into what you just said. You know, we're going to get to the defeat of the Spanish Armada, and it was mostly because of storms.
Yeah.
And it said, let's see, I'm just going to read it. English naval construction was so superb and their seamen so adept that, as the historian G.J. Marcus points out, during Elizabeth's entire 45-year reign, not a single English warship was lost through shipwreck. While over the same term of years, entire squadrons of Spaniards were overwhelmed by the sea. Mm. So I just find that an interesting contrast that they built the biggest ship anybody had ever seen, you know, but they also weren't very good at weathering the storms for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He talks about Charles V, and he inherited three different dynasties and he controlled most of Europe, but he was not content, and he conquered Italy too, and his troops, I guess, looted and burned much of Rome. And
so it doesn't sound like a Spanish guy, Charles the Fifth, but that was Spain. He was the Spanish king.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
He was the one that called Martin Luther to the Diet at Worms.
Uh-huh.
Diet is spelled diet. I know. And I have to tell the story. When I was a freshman, I had the same world history class with my roommate, and we were reviewing for the test, and I said, so tell me what you know, because these were essay tests. And I said, Jim, tell me what you know about Martin Luther. And he said, well, he was a priest and this, and he ate worms. And and I said, he ate worms? Yeah, it said he had a diet of worms.
It's sort of like a John the Baptist guy, right? Diet of worms. Oh my gosh.
That was, and he did better than me on the test even after that. So,
oh gosh,
pretty funny. But he became ill and he turned the empire over to Philip, and so it was interesting that in spite of all of the gold and silver they brought from the New World, that they were an enormous debt. So they must have been spending a lot.
You know what that makes me think of, Hampton, just casually almost? Often you'll see in the history of our own government here in the United States, hey, we're going to help this certain segment of the population, and they're just going to, you know, give them a cash infusion. That never helps. Right. It didn't help Spain to be important. All that, as weird as it sounds, help them.
Yeah. He mentioned in here that it was caused bad inflation.
Yeah.
You know, so printing money or stealing money
doesn't help.
Then he has a section called Pirates of the Caribbean.
I love that title.
It said that the French and the English governments cooperated with the fleets of privateers to rob the Spanish ships, and the Spanish called Queen Elizabeth the Pirate Queen, and her most famous pirate was Francis Drake. And he didn't just stop and steal from cargo from ships. He actually would get off the boat and go, you know, attack the mule trains coming down from the mines.
Mm-hmm.
And he even sailed around South America and attacked the Spanish in the Pacific Ocean where they weren't expecting him.
He's a fascinating character in history, Francis Drake.
Well, and the queen backing him and all that.
Right.
And then he talks about the Spain's Low Country Wars, and most of that section was about Philip's many wars to try to impose Catholicism on all the Protestant territories. One of the things that stood out was just his description of Philip.
Was a good guy, right?
Sounds like it. I'm just going to read the paragraph. But aside from being diligent, Philip was said to have been a pleasant and gracious man. But as a Habsburg, he had inherited a severely deformed lower jaw that interfered with both his eating and his speaking. The same deformity had afflicted his father, Charles V. The Habsburg jaw was the consequence of many generations of inbreeding. Nearly all Habsburg males married first cousins or their aunts or their nieces. In addition to these physical difficulties, Philip spent many of his years in mourning. He was married 4 times. 3 of his wives were immediate relatives, and each of these 3 died at childbirth. The 4th, Mary of England, died during the 4th year of their marriage, possibly of uterine cancer. In addition, most of his children died very young. Between 1517 and 1700, half of all Habsburg children died before their first birthdays.
Man.
As it happened, Philip's foreign affairs were equally unfortunate. So, anyway, I just found that interesting.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, I think it talked about both his Charles V and Philip, you know, were very conscientious, working to, you know, trying to do a good job.
They were compassionate administrators in a sense. Yeah. Trying to, you know, more statesmen than they were just politicians, but they couldn't develop any infrastructure in their empire. Really didn't have the wherewithal to do that. That's why the money would just flow through. It wouldn't really benefit them.
Well, he spent a lot of time talking about, you know, they spent a lot of money in all these wars trying to convert people back to Catholicism. And then Philip sent his armada to invade England, and it was unsuccessful because the English wouldn't bring their ships up close so that the infantry could board them. You know, you bring your boat up close and everybody jumps over the railing and fights with swords. They would just, they would just stand off and shoot them with their cannons.
Yeah. Why not? Why get into hand to hand?
And that's where I mentioned earlier that they finally gave up and headed home, and then they were all smoked. Many of them were sunk by the storm. He has a section called Spanish Realities, and he said that by the time of Philip's death, that it was obvious that Spain was in decline and that the main cause was the financial ruin. And they basically just spent more money than they should have.
Well, that doesn't sound familiar, does it?
No. And he talks about backwards Spain. He said, as for manufacturing, Spain had little, and most of what did exist soon perished when the flood of gold and silver from the Americas allowed far greater reliance on imports.
Yeah.
Nor did Spain develop much in the way of an indigenous merchant class. Its commercial life remained in the hands of foreigners, most of them from Italy. This was a source of pride among leading Spanish citizens, known as the Hidalgos. Manufacturing and commerce were for inferior people and nations. So let others toil for Spain, was how they put it.
Yes.
So I guess basically all that gold pouring in from the Americas removed the need for innovation.
Yeah, it didn't create anything. It didn't, but they just spent it.
Yeah. He has a section called Colonial Drift. And the main thing I got from that was that the Spanish went to the Americas to get rich and haul the loot back home. But the rest of Europe went to stay.
Yeah. Yeah. They know that from the immigration numbers.
Yeah. So, Let's see, read a section here. Immigrants from Britain came to the British colonies in North America in far greater numbers than came to Latin America from Spain. An estimated 600,000 between 1640 and 1760. Many others came from the Netherlands, France, Germany, and other parts of Europe. They did not come in search of feudal estates or to mine gold and silver. Most of them came because of the high wages prevailing in the colonies and the extraordinary opportunities to obtain fertile farmland or to set up a workshop or a store. They had no interest in going back.
Yeah, they were entrepreneurs, right? Yeah. They just saw a golden opportunity to develop a continent, whereas the Spanish guys were just interested in setting up a pipeline for the gold.
Mm-hmm. And then his conclusion for this chapter is called Legacy of a Flawed Empire. And I'm just going to read it.
Sure.
Despite everything, it must not be overlooked that it was the Spanish who created the global society. No doubt the Chinese could have sent Xing He's fleet east to the Americas, but they did not. And many European rulers could have funded Columbus, but it was Isabel and Ferdinand who did. As for the tragic epidemics that resulted from contact, they would have occurred whenever any outsiders, including the Chinese, reached the New World, as was bound to happen. If not in 1492, then surely within the next several decades. The fact remains that it was the Spanish who funded the first voyage and the Spanish who rapidly followed up. By the time of Columbus's third voyage, they had already set up an administrative apparatus in the Caribbean and a busy maritime network. As for the fall of the Spanish Empire, ironically, perhaps no monarchs in history were more conscientious, honest, or hardworking than Charles V and his son Philip II. Between them, they carefully built the Spanish Empire and ruled it for more than 80 years. Nearly every day, they rose early and worked diligently at administering this sprawling entity. Had they been wastrels or playboys, they might have done much less damage to the economies in their charge. I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
In contrast, the pirate queen ran a relaxed regime, treating her sea dogs more like business partners than subjects. And they responded with brilliant initiative. In the end, it was this English free enterprise approach that was the final undoing of the Spanish Empire.
Yeah, great observation.
Yeah, I felt like that's the theme we've seen constantly through this book is top down doesn't work.
Correct. Yeah.
No.
That's right.
So in the next section, next chapter.
Well, hold on. One second. Sorry. I asked a guy, I was at a fundraiser a few months ago, late fall. I was back. I was in Washington, D.C. And it was for a First Fruits ministry in Israel. And I asked, the gentleman that, at my table, right? We're sitting with maybe eight other people or so. And I said, what sort of economy is Jesus Christ going to run when he sets up his throne in Jerusalem, when he returns? And I mean, they looked at me with just blanks, like, what?
Never thought about it, huh?
Never thought about it. And I can't say I would have been able to answer that. Well, I'm not sure I could answer it now, but not sure I would ever have thought of that until recently, like in our own studies. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting question? In when we say top down doesn't work, is that because the top is not good? Whereas when Jesus returns, the top will be good. Then does it matter? I don't know. I tend to suspect the principles of capitalism, the reason capitalism thrives is because the principles behind it are valid. And if that's the case, then why wouldn't it be like that when Jesus returns? Though we're not voting on, so you're not going to vote Jesus in or out, right?
Right. Funny thought.
Right. But I imagine there will be principles of capitalism, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't it describe?
And monarchy works great if you have the perfect
benevolent. Yeah. But I think there will be, I guess maybe what I'm driving at more than anything else is individual ownership, right? Like your land and your endeavors will be yours. It's just you'll use them from a pure heart, but it will be yours.
Right? You're not going to just sit on a cloud and play a harp all day?
I'm hoping not, because I don't have any musical abilities. I'm hoping you guys do. I mean, I enjoy listening to music, but I don't want to be part of the band.
Right.
But anyway, sure. It's just an interesting question. Sorry I diverted us.
Well, that's okay. So chapter 13 is the Lutheran Reformation, Myths and Realities. And this is all happening at the same time as Charles V and Philip II. So it's very related.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read the first couple paragraphs in the intro. A year after Charles V became king of Spain, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Wittenberg church door.
Oh, good pronunciation. Thank you.
Yes. Well, I did live in Germany for 3 years.
I know. Good job.
Initiating the Reformation. The careers of the two would be closely intertwined in the brutal religious conflict that soon followed. A remarkable number of myths have gathered around the Reformation. Many of these reflect the anti-Catholic bias of the historians who long dominated what was written in English and much that was written in German. The conventional myths proclaim that the emergence of Protestantism was caused by enlightened factors such as the spread of literacy, and that it had many equally marvelous consequences, including a remarkable revival of popular piety and the spread of religious liberty. Unfortunately, many of the admirable claims about the Reformation aren't true. The rise of Protestantism was anything but the triumph of tolerance. It was a criminal offense to say Mass in Lutheran Germany. John Calvin tolerated no dissenters. Henry VIII burned dissenters. That hardly anyone went to church in either the Protestant or the Catholic areas of Europe quashes all claims of a popular revival.
Oh, of that's course. So fun.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Of course, the Reformation is itself a misnomer. There were several independent and quite different reformations, the primary instances being Lutheranism, Calvinism, and Anglicanism. But the first, most analyzed, and most important of these three reformations, and therefore the one that will be our main focus, was the one Martin Luther led.
So, well, I can hardly wait to get to those. Remember some of the letters they found, like the guys complaining about what actually happens in church?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, just to summarize, Luther and Lutheranism section is in 1510, Luther went to Rome and was appalled at the depravity and the impiety that he saw amongst the church leaders there. Erasmus went there about 5 years before Luther and complained about the same things.
Yeah.
And it was really the sale of indulgences that was the biggest thing that upset Luther.
And so what is that exactly?
Well, if you give money to the church, then they would get your relatives out of purgatory and into heaven. And I'm not sure how they did that. How people thought they could do that. That was kind of an interesting thought. Why didn't people question that? But I didn't know the word purgatory came from the idea of being purged of your sins.
Yeah.
So that was news to me when I read that. But on October 31st, 1517, Luther nailed his 95 theses on the church door in Wittenberg. It was basically a list of problems. And mainly with the indulgences. And the one paragraph here lists some of the other things. He says, Luther also proposed radical changes in both practice and doctrine. He called for an end to the sale of indulgences, to saying masses for the dead, and to all holy days except for Sundays. He declared that the whole congregation, not just the priest, should sip the communion wine. Moreover, he proposed that priests be allowed to marry and that no one be permitted to take the binding monastic vows before the age of 30. Later, he advised the dissolution of all religious orders and that there be no more vows of celibacy. As for doctrine, Luther asserted the absolute authority of Holy Scripture and that each human must discover the meaning of Scripture and establish his or her own personal relationship with God. Most radical of all, Luther proposed that salvation is God's gift, freely given, and is gained entirely by faith in Jesus as the Redeemer. That is, salvation cannot be earned or purchased by good works. Consequently, there is no purgatory, since no atonement for sins other than that wrought by Christ is necessary or possible. One either has faith and is saved, or lacks faith and is damned. Good works are the result or fruits of faith.
That sounds pretty biblically accurate.
Yeah, I think that's a great representation of what Luther taught.
Yeah, that's just straight from the Bible.
Yeah. So gospel message and everything right there. Yes. And so Luther went to the meeting in Worms, made his famous "Here I Stand" speech, and then was escorted back to Germany by a number of German princes and their soldiers.
Yeah, he might get killed for what he was doing.
Yeah. He talks about the causes of the Reformation. There's a lot of claims that are made.
And he kind of Hold on one sec, Hampton. I'm sorry. So the last paragraph before the causes of the Reformation.
Oh, okay.
Well, we have to, this could also be understood awkwardly. A rump session of the diet. Or
what is okay. A rump session?
I'm not sure. That caused me some concern when I read this.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, well, we should have looked it up.
Carry on.
So he talks about, there's a bunch of speculation or claims about the causes of the Reformation, and like, you know, the printing press. He has a section on the pamphlets and printers. The printing press had just been invented, and, you know, Luther let the printers, I guess the church wouldn't let him print anything. And he says, here, you can print my stuff. And so his writings were published and distributed. And there was no copyright law back then. So the printers all over the place would get a pamphlet and then print it. And so there were claims that that was a big reason for the spread. And Stark says does not really correspond to the spread of the Protestantism, because only 5% of the people could read, you know, only the upper class and maybe some of the middle class.
Yeah.
But I got to think that the ones who could read would have read it out loud and they would have had discussions. Sure. So I'm not sure he gives the printing presses enough credit.
Maybe not.
And then he talks about pastors and students, and our professors and students. And so they had the university at Wittenberg was preaching Lutheran doctrine. And so the students would go back to their towns. And so
have you ever been to Wittenberg?
I did go there. And I'm mixing up my towns. I can't remember if that was where it was or Rotenburg, but I was, I actually went in the room where he did much of his translation of the New Testament.
Oh, I see. Is it a pretty place?
Yeah, the castles and buildings are phenomenal all over Germany.
Well, yeah.
And, so I don't remember exactly what the outside of that looked like. I kind of sort of still see the inside in my mind.
I got you.
But he also pointed out that there were a lot of Catholic seminaries and, you know, those students would go back and spread Catholicism. But the thing I found the most interesting here was the responsive city governance section. And he's basically says in there that the free imperial cities who paid their taxes directly to the Catholic Church or the Holy Roman Emperor said that 2/3 of those converted to Protestantism. And perhaps the motivation was being partly to not have to pay taxes.
I'd imagine so.
And so he said there were, in the royal self-interest section, he says that about some countries like Denmark and Sweden and England, Henry VIII being the most famous one because he wanted to get divorces. And so he says in many instances, too, it was very much in the self-interest of the urban bourgeoisie for local church property to be confiscated and church authority curtailed. The church's extensive holdings in the free imperial cities, about a third of all property in most cities went untaxed. I'm going to insert here that one reason that the church had so much property was because the crusaders had to put their property up as collateral when they borrowed money from the church to go, you know, to finance those expeditions to the Holy Land.
Yeah, very good thinking, Hampton. Nice observation.
And so, you know, that also tied in with the indulgences, and the church was telling people they were, the Crusades is tied into this indulgences because the church was telling people they were guaranteed to go to heaven if they fought in the Crusades. Mm-hmm. Back to what he was saying, adding to the burden were the clergy and members of religious orders who made up as much as 10% of a city's population. These members of the church were exempt from all taxes, including tithes to the church, and all duties of citizenship, such as taking their turn as sentries on the walls, as all able-bodied non-clerical males were required to do. So the cities, too, had much to gain by expelling the church. As the 20th century British Catholic writer Hilary Belloc sums up, the Reformation benefited immensely from the chance presented to territorial lords, large and small, from kings down to squires, of looting church property. It is all well and good to note the widespread appeal of the doctrine that we are saved by faith alone, but it also must be recognized that Protestantism prevailed only where the local rulers or councils had not already imposed their rule over the church. Pocketbook issues prevailed.
Yeah, that's good.
The economy, stupid.
Well, that's exactly right. But that's great insight. You know, it wasn't this massive spiritual revival.
Yeah.
It was the pocketbook.
Right. Well, now he talks about the consequences. Was there a revival of mass piety? And he goes great detail with many quotes that almost nobody in Germany went to church. So this is the part. You have something you want to read from that?
Let me try to pick some out. Oh, my gosh. Maybe we'll just start with his general summary. The most widely accepted belief about the Lutheran Reformation is that it touched the hearts and souls of the German masses to such an extent that it resulted in a huge revival of popular piety. As Lawrence Stone put it, the combination of Luther and the printing press made the Bible available to the unsophisticated. The result was the most massive missionary drive in history, a combined assault on an assault on indifference, cynicism, paganism, and ignorance, marking the 16th century era of the rise of the Christian empire. Let me pause there. Would you describe in very general terms the church in the West today that way? I would. Indifference, cynicism, paganism, and ignorance. Oh my gosh. So well, then you get, go ahead.
In Saxony, I'm going to read this paragraph, you'll find more of them out fishing than at service. Those who do come walk out as soon as the pastor begins his sermon.
Yeah.
Irina, a pastor, testified that he often quits his church without preaching because not a soul has turned up to hear him. In Barham, It is the greatest and most widespread complaint of all pastors hereabouts that people do not go to church on Sundays. Nothing helps. They will not come, so that pastors face near empty churches. In Braunschweig, Grubenhagen, many churches are empty on Sundays. In Weilberg, absenteeism from church on Sundays was so widespread that the synod debated whether the city gate should be barred on Sunday mornings to lock everyone inside. The evidence from elsewhere suggests that that expedient would not have helped. So, and he just goes on and on with,
yeah, things like that. On and on. Oh my gosh. And they're like drunk in church and they're playing cards and stuff like that. And they, oh man, it's interesting time. So it wasn't this huge, I guess the point is it wasn't this huge spiritual revival. It was a pocketbook issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he talked about religious freedom is often claimed that, you know, came about, but that was not true. He just went from being a Catholic monopoly to a Protestant monopoly in the places where they switched. He said, and then he says, talks about the wars. First came the German Peasants' War, stirred up by Lutheran radicals in 1524. The war lasted a year, cost about 100,000 lives by the time it was suppressed. Then came the Schmalkaldic Wars, during which Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, tried to reimpose Catholicism all across Germany, arousing the opposition of a group of princes who had adopted Lutheranism. The war was settled in 1555 by the Peace of Augsburg, which recognized Protestant principalities. This peace soon broke down, and the Thirty Years' War began in 1618. By the war's end in 1648, Germany had been devastated. A third of the towns were wiped out, although about a third of, along with about a third of the population. But in the end, Protestant areas survived. In the Low Countries, the war to restore Catholicism lasted for 80 years, but the Dutch Protestants outlasted the Spanish. And of course, religion was a central aspect of the English Revolution. Nor did peace bring much more than grudging toleration. For the most part, Catholics were unwelcome in Protestant areas and vice versa.
Yeah, so remember we read, you know, Daniel covering those years of a Greek dominion over the Holy Land. I wonder what a Daniel kind of chapter would have been like covering the Reformation.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, the next section was Puritan achievements. And he says in the first paragraph, the most significant consequences claimed for the Reformation's involve effects that supposedly arose when Puritan forms of Protestantism emerged. Perhaps the most widely circulated of these is that the Puritans initiated an era of extreme sexual repression that has lived on to disfigure modern life. As Bertrand Russell put it, Puritanism consisted of the determination to avoid the pleasures of sex. If it turns out that this is a malicious myth, the Puritans were very frank and enlightened about sex! Exclamation.
So and, more of our social imaginary.
Well, and it's Bertrand Russell. I mean, if there's a Hall of Fame for evil people, he's probably an inductee.
Yeah. And they're completely wrong about the perspective the Puritans had. And if we were to go on and read some of these cases, they had like court cases where they were deciding in favor of, hey, like, you're not having enough sex.
Yeah.
Right. So
the wives were complaining and
yeah,
the husband wasn't doing his duty.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting.
Yeah.
The Catholic Reformation is the last section. I may just read this conclusion here. It says, probably the most profound and lasting consequence of the Protestant Reformation was that they prompted the Catholic Reformation or Counter-Reformation at the Council of Trent, which was 1551 and 2 and 1562 and 63. The Catholic Church ended simony, which was the sale of church offices, enforced priestly celibacy, they reacted to Luther's, you know, thing. Made available official inexpensive Bibles in local languages. And in short, the Church of Piety permanently replaced the Church of Power. At Trent, the church also decided to establish a network of seminaries to train men for the local priesthood. No longer would there be priests who did not know the seven deadly sins or who preached the Sermon on the Mount. By the 18th century, in most places, the church was staffed by literate men well-versed in theology. Even more important, the seminaries produced priests whose vocations had been shaped and tested in a formal institutional setting. But there was a dark side to the Catholic Reformation. The new spirit of strictness shifted the church's economic and intellectual outlook. A reemphasis on asceticism set the church against business and banking to such an extent that the false argument that Protestantism gave birth to capitalism could be taken seriously. The same sort of thing happened with science. Although Western science is rooted in Christian theology and arose in the medieval universities, the Catholic Reformation imposed such severe intellectual restrictions that Catholic universities declined in scientific significance. By the latter part of the 19th century, therefore, there flourished the mistaken belief that the Reformation gave birth to a scientific evolution.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, especially that first paragraph, because there must have been some real power in the Protestant Reformation, because the Catholics did respond, right? And they responded appropriately in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real Protestant Reformation, you know, back to more biblical roots, and that the Catholics did respond to that. Yeah. But as Stark points out, then they went kind of swung back the other way, the pendulum, you know, it sort of hurt them in other ways.
Right. I mean, finally, he says, if the Reformation failed to result in an era of religious liberty, it did at least produce organized diversity within Christendom. There was, of course, the division between Catholics and Protestants, but just as important was the diversity among Protestants. In fact, from earliest days, the term Protestant was a somewhat misleading label, meaning little more than that a person was a Christian who was not a Roman Catholic. Toleration, not only across the Catholic-Protestant divide, but also among Protestants, came only after centuries of bloodshed.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, there were quite a few myths there that he dispelled.
Yes. So one of the things that makes me think of, you know, my job when I'm coaching is really to coach the kids in swimming. But, you know, you get to know them. And hopefully, I think if you're doing your job well, you get to relate to them. Well, stuff comes up. And, I was goofing around. Do you remember Hazen?
Uh-huh.
So Hazen was the only one that showed up yesterday for the first practice. I think, you know, the weather was so bad that he ended up being the only one. So we were talking, and I goof around with him, and he loves the Marvel movies. And so, you know, I've, of course, have never seen them, but I know what he's talking about. So I said, hey, Hazen, you know, I'm just totally goofing around with them. I said, I could beat up Thanos. He just laughs. And I said, I could beat up Thor and the Hulk. And he's, you know, he's just laughing. And he says, yeah, but you can't beat up Jesus. And I
really,
it was, yeah. And it was interesting. You know, I said, no, you're right. You're right. I can't, you know, now I stop goofing around and we start talking. But be that as it may, what I tell the kids, because I'm really not there to preach, but at the same time, right, like I'm saying, stuff comes up. So what I tell the kids, you know, knowing some of the things they're taught in school these days, is I tell them, because they know I have contrary views on a lot of that stuff. And so they say, I tell them, look, you should learn everything you're taught. But you should believe only what you research. And Stark's a great example of that, right? You should learn there was a Protestant Revolution. There was a Spanish Empire. You should learn that stuff. But what you should believe about it are only the things that you can prove through research. Like part of that chapter on the Reformation, wasn't it so interesting about those sociologists that went back and looked up all those records at the German universities?
Yeah, I think that the Germans are hoarders. They keep all of their documents.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, another place you can do that. Well, anyway, I guess before I go on, my point is that's something you can really believe because that's real research.
Yes.
But just general statements about those times, you got to be careful with them. You know where else that comes into play is if anyone's ever tempted in this direction, it's fascinating research to look at the beginning of Mormonism. So mm-hmm. Joseph Smith in upstate New York, you can go back. I've got the book that does this and actually look at the card catalog of his little town library. And you can see the books he was reading. Isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. See, you don't have to guess about what was going on in Joseph Smith's mind or the story of Mormonism. You can go back and look at what he was reading, and what he was reading were things literally like Weird Tales magazine that circulated in Europe way before. And you find all the stories of Mormonism in there. All he really? Did was, yes, it's fascinating. He didn't originate that stuff. That came out of Weird Tales magazine.
Strange but true.
Strange but true. And the guy who did that research is a PhD guy, I think, from Yale, who's a Mormon.
Really?
He considers himself Mormon to this day.
He's still Mormon, but he knows.
Yes. Yes, beginning. He's just giving you the real data. So that you can sink your teeth into.
Yeah, that's a even more, truthful if that's coming right. from a Mormon.
That's right. So remember one of our core beliefs, right? The only thing that'll keep you from understanding something is laziness.
Right.
So do the research.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, Hampton.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.